Mark Eagle. By the way, the Federal Trade Commission has got a little rule, full or limited warranties. If you want to limit your express warranty in some way, you can do that. You got to make sure that that's contained in the language of the warranty and have that be conspicuous, something that the buyer is not going to be able to miss. If not, it's considered to be a full warranty, and I have to give the money back, basically. Usually sellers want to limit those express warranties. Well, we got other warranties, though, that may affect that. Implied warranty of merchantability. This goes with every item that is sold by the merchant. Not a very high standard. So the merchant doesn't have to say anything about the product. Implied warranty merchantability means that every good that a merchant sells has to be of fair and average quality and fit for the ordinary purposes for which it was intended. That's basically what it says.
So it's fair and average quality. That's not really different from the express warranty.
Well, the merchant doesn't have to give an express warranty.
No.
It's not required to at all. So, Bradford Stone, Professor Bradford Stone, was one of the authors of UCC. Unfortunately for me, he was a professor at my law school when I was there. And we took a whole course in sales, Article 2, an entire class. And I'll never forget, this was a long time ago, about 30 years ago. But more actually. He'd pick up a pen and he'd say, this pen just has to be an average pen and last for a reasonable period of time. And it's met in five warranty merchantability. So it's not a very high standard. But then again, if a merchant's going to be selling something for good money, people's hard-earned money, the item has to conform to some kind of standard. And fair and average quality. Kind of a minimal standard. There's another implied warranty. In fact, I just ran across this. I had a client of mine having problems with some windows that he got at Menards, and he sent me the language. He sent me a letter with it, and in the language of this contract, tried to waive the implied warranty merchantability. But I said, guess what? You've got another warranty that applies here, based upon what the salesman told him. Very close to express warranty, but it's not the same thing. Implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose under the code, Article 2. And the implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, I continue to squeak on the blackboard. You're the buyer, you're relying upon the recommendation of the salesperson. So you go in there in one of these big home type places, Builder Square, they used to have Builder Square, but you got Lowe's and other places like that, Menards. And you say, well, I'm kind of a novice at this. This is what I want to do. What do you recommend? What product do you recommend? I want to build a deck or something, and I want to know what kind of wood I should use, and I want to know what kind of stain I should use, and I want to be able to have a case like this. Long stay and the first heavy rain and it's bleeding all over the place. And so what is the best, what do you recommend for water resistance that will work? Make sure that my deck doesn't start bleeding the stain the first heavy rain. Oh, I know exactly what you need. And he goes in the back room and grabs something, comes out here. This is based upon what you told me you wanted to do and what you're concerned about, I recommend this product. He doesn't have to say anything about the product. That's why this is different than express warranty. Express warranty, there has to be a promise about the condition or the authenticity or the materials used or the properties in a particular, it's a particular good that you're buying. Here, you're just relying on the salesperson's recommendation after you tell the salesperson what it is you're trying to accomplish. And then, if you then use it, and it turns out it is just the opposite of what he said it would, and it's all messed everything up, you can come back to this person or in the store where you applied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose. Sue the store under what we call vicarious liability. This is the next area of the law we're going to talk about again, which is principals and agents. Salesman is acting as an agent for the store. You never want to sue the agent because they don't have any money. You want to sue the store. Deep pockets. That's who you sue. And so under principle, under law, principals, P-L-E-S, of principals and agents, P-A-L-S, law, there's vicarious liability in the store as responsible for a breach of implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose because their salesman recommended a product that didn't work. Somebody had a hand up?
Yeah, is that why more and more places I go into and say, hey, what do you recommend about this? They say, I can't really tell you.
Yeah. The store probably told them they'll do that. We're going to sue a few times that way because of this implied warranty. Back to the implied warranty of merchantability, this is why we got the lemon law in Michigan. This came in, the code came in the late 50s, early 60s. Under the implied warranty of merchantability, if that car that you bought was not a fair and average quality because you had to keep taking it back to the shop every week or so, and it never seemed to really get fixed, you are entitled to a new car. Because you only have to take it in a reasonable amount of time, and if they don't fix it, you don't have to keep taking it in. You're entitled to a new car under the implied warranty of merchantability. So the automobile dealers went to Lansing and said, you've got to figure out something else. This is going to kill us. So this is where the Lemon Law came.
You mentioned that the fellow Menards tried to write a contract that exempted them from their implied warranty.
The Menards guy recommended these windows for this guy because he was building a house. And the guy bought these windows, and they leak. The water comes through.
So would a judge enforce a provision of a contract that specifically waives their requirement to deliver?
That's the next thing we're going to get to.
Okay.
Good question. And if you looked at these problems, those of you that are going to be doing these, you'll see some of that. Yes, you can answer your question, Lucas. He wants to know, can the store put waiver language to make sure that they're not going to be responsible for any breach of implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose? In other words, the store is being concerned about the salespeople getting a little bit out of control. Try to rein in some of those salespeople so the salespeople don't end up getting them sued. If you have a conflict between In the same transaction, if you've got waiver language and you've got a statement that would constitute the implied warranty of fitness for a particular purpose, case law says when there's an ambiguity, you apply it, not the waiver. For implied warranty of merchantability, the waiver has to be old type, two rules. Waiver language means the store wants to say, we're not responsible for the implied warranty of merchantability on this product we're selling you. That's waiver language. It doesn't apply to us. That's what waiver means. The waiver language has to be a bold type, and the word merchantability has to be used because that has legal significance. Think of the position the seller is putting themselves. We want to be able to take this person's money, but we don't even want to say the product we sold them was even a fair and average quality and fit for the ordinary purposes for which it was intended. So the seller, to get the judge to do what the seller wants, which is to enforce the waiver language, is put in that silly position. You got a judge sitting there, oh yeah? Well, what is it that you sold them then? If it isn't even a fair and average quality, if it's not even fit for the purposes that they went in the store and bought it, what are you saying it is? So, even though you have waiver language for the implied warranty of merchantability, that's not exactly the best legal position to be in court.
makes a difference whether the seller is, what does the seller have to be, do to become a merchant?
To be in regular business of selling goods. And so when we have our cases in our court, if you've got, and I don't spend a lot of time looking at those cases because I don't want to know actually what they are. I don't want to do anything to tip off and help one side or the other. But if you've got some waiver language on the other side, you can always, you can argue public policy. This shouldn't be enforced. Just think of the ramifications of this, Judge, if this gets enforced. This is a prescription for rip-offs and for fraud. Or argue unconscionability. It's unconscionable. They don't even have to sell a product and get money for it that said even a fair and average quality and fit for the ordinary purposes for which it was intended. Remember I told you that the court, our court in here has the authority to change case law, okay, for public policy reasons. Our court can do that if they want to do it, and you can ask the court to do that on your case if you want. So just because, here's the rule on waiver language, and here's a bad, that's an easy one, no. I want to see a little bit of creativity and argument on it.
Is there any special rules for people who literally sell junk, like junkyards and where you go and you're buying garbage?
Like the people that come by on extra trash day up and down the street here once a month and take, in fact, I got to put some stuff on.
Where are you putting up?
Yeah. I think there are some statutes.
Okay.
On that kind of stuff. But again, once they pick it up, once it's on the outlaw, then it's theirs.
What about an auction house?
Abandoned property.
The auctioneer, auction house, do they have a merchant license?
Well, he had the rule with reserve and without reserve. He covered that.
Right.
Do you have to have a license to be an auctioneer? I'm not sure. Anybody here go to auctions?
I think you do. I think so.
I think there is a requirement for a license. And anytime there's a requirement for a license, guess what? You better not have a felony conviction and get a license, isn't it? I'll guarantee you that. They do a background check, and I think maybe you have to be bonded by a bonding company. You know what that means? Anybody not know what that means?
Bonded by a bond company.
That means you have to have your credit, you have to pass a background check, and your credit has to be at least good enough such that somebody would issue a surety bond for you. Which means you pay a company a fee, they issue a surety bond for you, meaning that they say, this guy messes up, steals the property, doesn't follow the rules, we'll pay. Like an insurance policy. Okay, definition of limited warranties and full warranties I mentioned, but I didn't really explain the difference to you. On page 560. And companies almost always are doing limited warranties. But they don't say it's a limited warranty in their language, it's full. A limited warranty is any warranty that does not meet the requirements in the full warranty. A warranty is limited if the buyer must pay any cost for repair or replacement of a defective product. So a limited warranty says, you don't exactly get everything paid for. You don't exactly get all of your money back. Here's what we will do for you. That's what a limited warranty is. Full warranty, get your money back. Get exactly reimbursed, exactly made whole, as most companies don't want to do that. It was mentioned in here, warranty of title. Yes, I'm not going to have that on the test. And of course, warranty of title means when you sell something to somebody, you're warranting that you own this. That this is yours, and you have title to sell it. And every time a merchant sells a product, the warranty of title goes with it too. But I don't have that on the test. Get a nice summary chart also on page 569. We mentioned the Magnuson-Moss Federal Consumer Product Warranty Law. That's this thing about full and limited warranty. I don't have that on the test, but it's a good thing for you to know. Okay, chapter 26, obligations and performance. Obligation of good faith for any party that is involved in the sale of goods under the UCC. anticipatory repudiation rule on 582, same as a common law, for all intents and purposes. But here's something that's new, 582, adequate assurance of performance. So I think I left off with 8 changes from common law when I had them all on the board before. This would be the 9th. It's not at all in common law.
I got 7.
Adequate assurance of performance rule means that you have some concerns about whether or not the goods that are supposed to get delivered to you on April 1st are actually going to get delivered to you on April 1st based upon some things you know about that company. You have a strong suspicion that they're going to breach and not deliver to you on April 1st. You have the right to send them a letter on February 1st and demand that they reply to you no later than March 1st to assure you that they are going to, in fact, deliver the goods on the day they're supposed to, on April 1st. If they then fail to respond, they fail to give assurance within 30 days, by March 1st, you consider the contract discharged. Common law, no. There's each side has a duty to perform, and they have a duty to perform according to the terms of the contract, and that's just it. Not so under the code. So you're saying, hey, I gotta know, because if he isn't gonna bring over, if he's gonna file bankruptcy, this is a concern with a lot of businesses now. Do I extend credit? Is this person going under? Am I ever going to see the money? Are they going to file a bankruptcy? I got to know before March 29th whether I'm going to get those goods April 1st or I'm screwed. So I got to know by March 1st. I need some time to be able to negotiate and not buy under stress substitute goods. Because if I got to buy within a day or two substitute goods, I won't have time to negotiate the price. I'm going to have to pay top dollar. If I got at least a month, I've got a time to check the market out, and I got a time to negotiate a good price. And so I can't wait until March 31st to find out that he's coming April 1st. That's the purpose of that rule. Adequate assurance of performance. Okay. Duties. Seller's duty to deliver. In the manner, it depends upon if the parties have agreed, whether the shipper is a nation contract, whether or not the shipper is an employee of one of the parties, whether it's a third party bailee, and whatever the case may be. Buyer's right to examine the goods, buyer's right to inspection. This is very important. The buyer always has the right to inspect goods when they are delivered. Sometimes a seller tries to circumvent that, like a COD transaction, mentioned here in 584. COD transaction, the mailman isn't going to give you the box, package, until you sign for him and give him a check. Sign for him and give him a check, collect on delivery, he gives you the package. You haven't had a right to inspect them yet. Because, as we already know, the lumpy tender rule, the buyer is entitled to get the goods in perfect tender condition, which means they conform to the specification that I told him I needed. They look like the stuff in the pictures in the catalog. They were made of the material that I ordered. I don't want that cheap stuff. I wanted this material. Perfect tender condition, exactly what I ordered. And the buyer isn't going to be able to know that they get them in perfect tender condition unless they have the right to be able to inspect the goods. So in a COD transaction, or in a situation where it's not possible for the buyer to be able to fully inspect all the goods that are delivered to them without taking some time to do that, the buyer has a period of time in which the buyer can revoke acceptance once they have a reasonable time to conduct a full inspection of the goods. I mean, in these transactions with Dow and Dow Corning, the buyer isn't going to be able to inspect the goods in 5 minutes. They'll probably have to go through some testing. They got to have their experts come in, run some tests, check them all out. That takes time. Otherwise, the general rule is, like, you buy something, and it's only going to take you 5 seconds to inspect it. You buy a roast, or you go down and you buy a snowblower. You got to be able to make sure it works. Okay? You accept it. Money is paid. The buyer accepts it. The transaction is complete. The buyer's had a reasonable opportunity to inspect the goods. So even in a COD transaction, the buyer and, you know, the postman isn't going to hang around and wait. They're going to take off. You have the right to inspect the goods, and if they're not in perfect tender condition, the buyer is supposed to immediately notify the seller that they are revoking their acceptance. Always do that immediately if you're ever in that position. Never wait. People that sit on their rights and wait when they may have some liabilities oftentimes lose because they waited, and time doesn't help them. So the buyer can, if the seller is willing to give the buyer time and remain there while they inspect them, that's great. The goods haven't been accepted yet, the buyer can inspect them, make sure that they're in perfect tender condition. Or if the seller just delivers them to the buyer and leaves and they're under the buyer's control, the buyer has a reasonable period of time to revoke acceptance of goods they've already accepted to give them time to conduct a reasonable inspection and make sure they're in perfect tender condition. Well, what happens if they're not in perfect tender condition? Obviously, you have to notify in specific notice. Don't just say, these goods are not in perfect tender condition. That's a term I learned in Mr. Dunn's class, and that's all I'm going to tell you. No. You've got to tell them exactly what the problem is. Particularized notice is the safest practice. Why? Because the seller has a right to cure the defect. Again, the public policy behind these rules is to make the contract go whenever possible. Not have everybody end up in court. Not have everybody back to square one. To make the goods move through the marketplace as readily as they can. So the seller has a right to cure the defect. Years? Of course not. Reasonable period of time. Buyer needs this stuff right now. The buyer's business depends on having these goods work for them. And so seller has to cure the defect asset. Or what do we have? Compensatory damages, incidental damages. 10-second brain lock. Remember that from last class, incidental damages. A non-breaching party's out-of-pocket expenses in dealing with breach by the other party. And what might those incidental damages be? I got to store these damn things and wait for the seller to show up to fix them. So I'm going to store them here. But I'm going to charge that seller rental for that. Or maybe it's stuff that has to be refrigerated. I've got to go and put this stuff in, refrigerate this stuff, and create space for it. That's an out-of-pocket expense. Or maybe the buyer has to ship them back to the seller because the seller can only do the fixing on the seller's premises. And so that shipment back, that transportation back to the seller, is another one of the buyer's incidental damages that the buyer can collect from the seller. And how is that usually taken care of? Adjustment of the price. It comes off the price. If the goods hadn't been fully paid for it. But once a buyer accepts the goods, defective, not a perfect tender condition, and doesn't do anything for a reasonable period of time, 30, 60, 90 days, or you're really pushing it. 90 days, forget it. You've accepted the goods. Once you've accepted them, contract's complete.
Say it's a food product. They ship you boxes of whatever ingredients for whatever food.
Omaha steak.
And say...
Omaha steaks?
So say you look at it, and you look at the product and say, yes, I ordered ham, or I ordered whatever, you know, I ordered pepperoni, or I ordered cheese, or whatever. So yeah, I ordered the cheese, this is what I ordered. And you sign the paper from the delivery guy, yep, I ordered this cheese. But now when you open up the box, when it's time to use it, and you notice, say, it was frozen 7 months ago, 8 months,
you can
9 months ago.
You revoke acceptance, as long as you do it within a reasonable period of time.
All right, as long as you
do it. Immediately send them an email, particularizing the problem and demanding that they fix it. Never wait. People that wait are the people that lose. Immediately do it. Because sometimes you can't tell right away. Sometimes it's not even as easy as opening the box. You can't always tell right away. You know, you get a big, huge shipment, and maybe the first 10 boxes were just fine. Well, then you got into the next 10 boxes, and you got problems.
So the post office must have a rule also that they can deliver a package to a certain address, because they don't ever check your ID. You know, you can sign Joe Schmo's name on there, grab the package, and accept it. And the post office, as long as they took it to the address, they're not liable for anything, correct?
The post office?
Yeah.
Oh, hell no. Government. The first rule of government is they protect themselves.
Right.
Most government people have immunity from laws.
I signed
in most situations.
I signed with my own name before for somebody else. Like, I've had, when I was living in Florida, I had somebody knock on my door from the post office, and I opened it up. And one of my other roommates, he handed me a package, and I said, dude, I'm not this guy. And he's like, I don't care who signed here.
But see, it's going to depend whether it's a shipment or destination contract.
Right.
Because if it was a destination contract, I don't care that the postman screwed up. It was the seller's responsibility to deliver it to the buyer any way it can in perfect tender condition. So it says, what constitutes an acceptance of goods? Keeping it and not notifying the buyer that there's a problem with the perfect tender. That's acceptance. Once they accept them, that lets the seller off the hook. The seller is not under the obligation to cure defects anymore because the seller hasn't been given notice of the defect. Buyer's duty to pay, 588. Contract can indicate, however, whatever it's to be, if the contract doesn't say anything, payment expected when goods are transferred. Obligations of performance, 26. Time limits for suits under the UCC, statute of limitations. 6 years was the common law for breach of contracts. I don't think that has changed. That's the same. Torts three, half as long as torts. Particular torts even less. Medical and legal malpractice is 2 years, slander and libel 1 year. You don't need to worry about that. Your own information. All right. Where are we? Obligations of performance. I jumped ahead. I already did obligations. Now we're on 27. Credits. Rolling right along here. Remedies of the seller we start with. Most of this is common sense stuff. So remedy is what happens when the buyer's a material breach. What can the seller do? Few of these things are new, but most of it's the same as the common. Once there's been a material breach by the buyer, seller doesn't have to do anything else to perform. Seller finds out buyer is not going to pay, and the goods are still in shipment. Seller can stop shipment, turn the truck around, have the truck return the goods to sellers. Place of business. And cost of that trucker doing that is then part of the seller's incidental damages the seller can become the buyer. So that's seller's remedy number one. Number two, resale by the seller. Well, actually, let's back up. Seller's lien. Sometimes what a seller might do is go to court and get a lien in goods in the buyer's possession. That's usually kind of a cumbersome way of doing it. Most sellers won't do that. That is a remedy that's available. Resale, but back down to resale by the seller. Okay, seller's got goods. that have been identified to the sale, set aside for the buyer, not part of the greater mass, made available for the buyer, and the buyer never came through with the money. Fine. Seller can then resell the goods, but if he can't get as good a price, he or she can't get as good a price, then they can collect the difference from the buyer, and that's called what kind of damages?
Consequential.
Compensatory. Those are the, because those are the damages that flow directly from the breach of contract, not the non-breaching party's out-of-pocket expenses in dealing with the breach of contract. Because that seller was entitled to be made whole, and the only way that seller could be made whole is if that seller got the price they were supposed to get in the contract they negotiated with that buyer. And he did. Because he had to suddenly go out quickly, and they may have been perishable goods, which means he didn't have time to really negotiate a good price. Or he can't, doesn't have time to negotiate a good price because he has to move on it. Because of the way his business operates. He can't leave them here. We got to move them. Go, go, go. And so he had to agree to the first price, the first offer that he got. It wasn't as good a deal. Compensatory damages for the difference in the two prices. Anybody with me on that? Okay. We're just canceling the contract. Seller can do that. So we're saying when buyer breaches. Buyer says I'm not going to pay, number one. Buyer's check bounces, number two. Buyer files bankruptcy, number three. The buyer does something else, it's a material breach.
Are contracts considered broken just because you filed bankruptcy?
Yes, because they can't, you can't enforce the contract at that point. There's an automatic stay effect of all contracts until such time as the bankruptcy court recreates the obligation. And that can be done with what's called a... What the hell is it called? I haven't done bankruptcy law since 2006. Reaffirmation agreement. Yes. Happens all the time. Going bankrupt? Yeah, but I need my car to go to work. So we do a reaffirmation agreement. Keep the car loan. But I still got to live in a house. Reaffirmation agreement on the mortgage. But you can only do that if you only have a certain amount of equity, because you can only exempt a certain amount of equity. If you've got $50,000 of equity in your house, you will lose the house. The bankruptcy trustee is going to take the house and say, here's your check for your exempt amount. Go out and do whatever you want. Something like $36,000 or something. The rest of the loan is the bankruptcy. Okay, other seller's damages. Buyers in breach. Seller's action for damages under the market price formula. Well, maybe the seller couldn't find anybody else to buy the goods. Maybe because there just isn't a market out there. And nobody wants them anymore. Maybe they were sitting around too long. They don't have the value that they did. Seller can get the entire price for the buyer. Seller's action for lost profits. Remember the rule on, and these are called, this is called consequential damages. Remember from last time. Three kinds of damages. Incidental damages, out-of-pocket costs, compensatory damages that flow directly because you didn't get the contract deal you were supposed to, and consequential damages are lost profits. Because had this contract been performed as it was supposed to, you would have made profit on it, on resale. So that's, when they say seller's action for lost profits, those are consequential damages, and remember the rule on that. Have to be reasonably foreseeable to the breaching party. Breaching party had to have reason to believe that you would have made a profit on this contract had they come through the way they were supposed to. Okay, other damages, we talked about that. Seller's action for the purchase price, we talked about that. Non-sale remedies. Security interest and pledge, discussed on 602. Secure transactions is covered in business law too. But a pledge, or as I like to call it, furniture polish. A pledge is when, the best example I can give you, anybody here ever run out of gas and had to go to walk to a gas station? The gas station gave you a gas can with gas in it, but you had to give them something back to make sure that you would return the gas can. That's called a pledge or furniture polish. On one of my tests, you can call a furniture policy or you can call the place, I don't care. But they wanted to make sure you didn't take off with their gas can. So maybe you gave them $10, or maybe you gave them a watch on your wrist because you didn't have any money other than the money to pay for the gas in the gas can. Or you gave them your cell phone or whatever you gave them to make sure you would come back. That's called a pledge. If you have a buyer and a seller in a marketplace and the credit of one of them is a little shaky, one of them might have required some sort of pledge. Let me hold on to some of your goods here until we get done paying for these goods. That's called a pledge. And so the buyer doesn't come through, doesn't pay for all the goods that he got, and you can keep these other goods because they were pledged as security. And another nice little summary chart here on page 603, if someone's ready. Then we get to the remedies of the buyer. What are all the various things the buyer can do when the seller is in the material breach? Rejection of the improper tender. Under the love me tender rule, this stuff just doesn't stack up. It's a wrong color. It's a wrong size. It can be a million things. But it's clearly not what it's supposed to be. They can revoke the acceptance that you already, we talked about that already, that they already made of the goods once they had a reasonable opportunity to fully inspect them. Buyer's action for damages for non-delivery, market price recovery. What is the market value of the goods the seller never delivered that they were supposed to? Buyer can recover that. Buyer's action to cover. Cover means I had to go out and buy goods somewhere else because you didn't deliver them as you were supposed to. And I had to pay a greater price because I didn't have enough time to negotiate a good price. I had to go out and grab the first goods I saw, or I'd have been in serious trouble. I would have been sued by this other guy here because I was supposed to have these goods, turn them around, add something to them, and sell them to him. And I didn't have time to wait. I had to go out quick, grab it, the first price I could get, much higher price. And so I now am entitled to get the difference between the price I was forced to pay in stress and the price that I should have got under this contract had the seller come through as they were supposed to and not breach them. Action for breach of warranty. You can do that. You can say, these goods aren't the value they were supposed to be. I could still use them, but they were of inferior quality. I was better off having them than not having them. So I get the difference between the value of the goods that I got that weren't in perfect tender condition. And what they would have been had they been in perfect tender condition. If you're ever going to be in that situation as the buyer, you've got to immediately let the seller know that you're going to keep the goods, but you intend that you require the seller to make up the difference. Difference in the price. Otherwise, you may end up getting an argument, he can't sue me, he accepted those goods. I don't care. If he says they weren't in perfect tender condition, he accepted them. And now he comes along a year later and wants to sue me for the difference between a condition as he thinks they should have been and as he accepted them. Don't ever do anything like that. Don't ever wait a year. Immediately let them know what the problem is and what you and demand that they do what you want them to do. Buyer's resale of goods. Buyer rejected the goods because they weren't in perfect tender condition, but seller refused to pick them up. Seller refused to accept them back. The buyer says, well, didn't Mr. Dunn say that you have a duty, the non-breaching party has a duty to mitigate damages? In other words, take reasonable good faith steps to try to prevent a lawsuit here. And so the buyer did, I'm going to sell these goods to somebody else, I have to mark the price way down in order to sell them because they're not of high quality. I'm going to sell them and apply that to seller's account. And so at least I got something for them. Seller, you're going to make up the difference.
If you never accepted them, then you don't technically have the title. So how do you resell them since you don't have the title?
No, you did accept them. You've got them in your possession. That's the example I gave you. You decided to keep them. You demanded that seller pick them up, but they didn't pick them up. So you still got them. You didn't dump them out on the street. You sold them for seller's account because you could sell them. Bananas that weren't green when you got them. They're already yellow. Maybe with a spot or two. They shouldn't be. They should be green when they get to the retailer. You can sell them right now, but you're probably going to mark them down 50 or 75% at your store. And so you do that, and people come in and buy them. You apply that to the seller's account, and then you're entitled to the difference as your compensatory basis. Action for specific performance. Buyer might say, Your Honor, money isn't doing me any good here. I got to have those goods. All right, I can't get them anywhere else. There's nowhere else I can get them. This is the only company that makes them. He's got them on his lot, and he won't give them to me. I paid for them. So, Judge, give me an equitable remedy of specific performance, meaning order him at the risk of contempt of court to deliver those to me, or order him to allow me to send my truck over there to pick them up. That's the buyer's specific performance remedy. Okay, 608, liquidated damages provision again. Same rule as common law. It's got to be reasonable. It's got to be at least a ballpark effort estimate as to what the actual damages would be for a court to enforce it. Again, and for those of you that weren't here last week, a liquidated damages provision is when the contract between the parties specifies that if the goods are inferior, here's what you pay. Or you pay me X amount of dollars for every day until I get goods that are of perfect tender quality, whatever the provision is. If it appears to be a provision that is not so one-sided that it would cause one party or the other to get annihilated in the agreement, pretty much, the court will enforce it. It's got to at least be a rough guess, estimate, ballpark attempt to measure the actual damages to be enforced. Otherwise, the court won't enforce it. Limitation of remedies. Some of these companies try to get you to agree in the contract that in the event there is a dispute, we have to go through binding arbitration. I hate that. Binding arbitration. Who the hell is going to do the arbitration? We don't know. Some faceless person that's going to come in from out of town that really doesn't know the market conditions in that community or the practices of that business, and he or she is going to just decide it. You should resist. You're in the position of having to be forced to agree to that. You should resist agreeing to that. If that company really wants your business, they'll take that out. And if there's anything you get out of this class, is somebody just hands you a contract and says, this is the contract. This is the way it's going to be. No. It's supposed to be offer and acceptance, counteroffer, right? Negotiated. How about this? You agree to this, I'll give you that, you give me this. That's the way it should be. And if there's a provision in there you don't like, take it out. Take your pen and cross it out, sign it, and send it back to them. No, I'm not agreeing to this. Yes, I want to do business with you. Yes, I think we can both make money here. I'm not agreeing to that provision in the contract. Take that out. There's no reason in the world why you can't do that. You can do it. Wow, that's damn good.
Why?
Four chapters? In 2.5 hours? That's
incredible.
Now I can do one of two things here. Got a little bit more time. We can do some problems, or I can start into some other really important material that's not on the next test. Many of you feel that is sales stuff, and I think maybe we need to do some problems here. Or else I can talk about enforcement of judgments And I can do that in 15 minutes.
And that will be on the final test?
That will be the final test.
Not on the last test.
No. You've got all the material in the huge, huge section. Contracts and sales. You've got all the material that's going to be done. The next week we'll review. Well, let me do that. I'm not sitting here and anybody want to do problems. I'm not hearing that. Because I'm, you know, we're one class down, and I want to get you as much information as I can before you leave here. I really want you to be experts on all this stuff, so let's do this. Okay, so now you're done with your breach of contract lawsuit, and you won, and you got a money judgment against this person. Now, how do you enforce it? We already talked about enforcing equitable judgment, show cause action, right? You have the person dragged before the judge as to why they shouldn't be held in contempt of court for violating an order of the court, which is ordering the person to do something or not to do something. That's done through contempt and show cause. Well, what about if you got a money damages judgment? Charter Smith. Writ of execution. For the dumb special. Let's do this in reverse order because the garnishment is the longest discussion. Dumb special. You can force this person that owes you money to appear in court. Call a creditor's exam or a discovery scheme. Call one or the other. It's the same form. Have any of you ever been served with a subpoena to go to court and testify? It's the exact same form. You can use it. You can use it for a number of different things. You've got a money judgment against the person. If you sue somebody in small claims court, not only get your judgment, but get ask the judge for your court costs reimbursed. Judgments run, incur interest. And there's a scale, and it changes all the time. Right now, it's approximately 5% of some interest. So you get it to enforce a judgment. Make sure, if it's been around a long time, you get the interest in it on it too, before you start trying to collect it. By the way, money judgments are good for 10 years, and you can renew them for another 10 years. But if you don't renew that judgment, within 10 years after the time you get it, it expires. So it'll never let it expire.
How do you go about renewing that judgment?
You just go down to the district court window and say you want to renew your judgment. And there's a form. You just fill out the form, give it to them, you renew it. It's very simple. Okay, this has to be personally served on this person. This creditor exam discovery subpoena document. The purpose of making them show up in the court where you got the judgment against them is to answer questions under oath regarding their financial condition and their ability to pay. We don't have debtors' prisons in Michigan. This person isn't going to go to jail if they can't pay, if they don't show up. That's why I call it a dumb special. They have to be personally served for the contempt powers of the court. And that's because of the constitutional provisions in the Fifth Amendment regarding notice and that sort of thing, without getting too deep into that. So, personally served them with it, that on such and such a day, at such and such a time, they must appear in court for you to ask them questions under oath. So they get sworn, and then the judge leaves. And then you and them remain in the courtroom, and you get to ask them any questions you want. Why do I call it a dumb special? Because if I do it, I try to have, this is one of my tricks, I try to have somebody with me. And as soon as I find out where their bank is, where they have their bank account, that's the first question I ask. I have the garnishment form already. I just simply put the name of the bank in the garnishment form. I keep the person in the courtroom and ask them questions because they have to stay. I send that other person down to the district court window to file the garnishment, and they run over to the bank or the credit union and serve the garnishment. And I keep the person in the courtroom so they can't go down and take the money out of their account. That's why I call it non-special. Did this one time, I got $50,000 that way. Ooh, I just got lucky. Just practicing law for a number of years, you learn the tricks and things that you can do. But most of the time, I don't want them to show up. Because if they do show up, you're just going to give me a bunch of BS anyway, usually. they're not going to get all that good information. Sometimes they're too stupid enough not to know what you're really doing there, and they might give you that good information. Oh, yeah, I got an account at PNC, and I got an account at the credit union. In fact, here's the title of my car, and I got this, and I work, and I make $20 an hour for Dow. Oh, thank you very much. Throw down into the garbage. So the creditors exam, if they don't show up, some judges will give them one more chance and issue what they call a show cause, sort of like enforcing an equitable judgment in certain court, which means they have to come and show cause why they shouldn't go to jail for not showing up, and the judge will give them a chance to give them a good excuse. But some courts will issue a bench warrant for the person's arrest if they don't show up for this hearing. And the amount of bond on the warrant to get them out of jail is the amount of the judgment, the amount of the money they owe you on the judgment. So I call this the Dunn special. Okay. Writ of execution, pain in the butt, difficult to do. You got to get a double indemnity bond from a bonding company. That's expensive. Writ of execution means you're getting an order to give to the sheriff. The sheriff is going to go out and seize property. There's going to be a sale at the courthouse. Any of you ever go to courthouses and you see a sheriff's deputy there, and he's in a room or he's huddled and there's 6 or 7 people around him and he's got papers in his hands. That's what he's doing. Those are people bidding on that property that the sheriff has seized for sale and under the writ of execution. Writ of execution doesn't mean the person's going to go to the firing squad. It doesn't mean that. It's actually, there's another term for this called attachment. Somebody who is a judgment creditor is able to convert that judgment into an order seizing property to have sold to apply to the judgment that they owe. Not too many major companies, debtors that are businesses with inventories get this. Or a car lot, a car dealership is probably going to be dealing with a writ of execution if there's a judgment against them because there are lots of vehicles there for the sheriff to come and seize. Now I'm going to talk about garnishment, unless there's questions. Two types of garnishments, periodic and non-periodic. Just the easy one first, the non-periodic. Non-periodic is a one-time hit on a bank account. It's in their standard form. You can get these things online. There's 4 books you can buy in office supply stores that have all these forms. And they're fairly simple fill-in-the-blank forms. So now what we're really, a garnishment, what it literally is the judgment creditor, the one who's owed the money, is suing the bank of the judgment debtor to try to get the judgment debtor's assets to apply to the judgment. So now we basically have a 3-party lawsuit. The garnishee defendant and the judgment defendant. You've got 2 defendants. The bank, once they've been personally served with this garnishment and they get a check with that, they get a fee for having to do this, has to, in 21 days, file a disclosure. Do they or do they not have money to this garnishee defendant? Now, they may have some money, but they may have the right of a set-off. Set off, banks that are smart will do this. If a bank has a financing agreement with that depositor, let's say the judgment defendant has a bank account, their savings account there, but they also have a car loan there. What the bank can do is to say that we are holding all of your savings account money, which goes up and it goes down, as security for this car loan. Credit unions will do this because credit unions are vulnerable. I mean, if they lose a couple of big judgments, they get burned on a couple of big loans, that credit union is going to be in trouble. So they assert for themselves in their finance contract with their depositor a right of set-off in the event that depositor ever has a judgment entered against them and somebody's going to try to garnish that money out of the account. Or there's a superior hold or a superior lien on that account. Somebody got there first. like the IRS would be the best example of that. The IRS manages to slap a lien on that account before you were able to serve your non-juriata garnishment. So they got priority on the money.
What did you hit it before?
Or maybe an order from a circuit court trying to collect child support.
Now, if you hit it before the IRS shows up, do they trump you going over you, even if you've been, like, if you...
No, so whichever one gets served first. It's a race in time. Just like in bankruptcy, same thing. It's a race in time. Whoever got there first has priority. And so it's a one-time disclosure. On this day, how much money did this depositor have in this bank? And guess what? If they don't file a response, remember those default rules we talked about at the beginning of the class? They can get defaulted for the entire amount. So they don't file a disclosure in the 21 days. And the judgment creditor can file a default against them. Now, the bank has 21 days to prove excusable neglect. Remember the two ways to set aside a default? Show you have a meritorious defense, which means you'd likely win. And two, you had a good excuse as to why you couldn't have filed the disclosure on time or the answer on time. And boy, somebody that works at a bank, that's one good way to lose your job, is to not file that disclosure within the 21 days and put that bank at risk like that. Periodic garnishment. Last thing we'll talk about. Employer. They are good for 90 days. Employers dread these things. Employers will usually call an employee in and say, take care of this damn thing. I don't want to be filing all these darn disclosures. Every pay period they have to file a disclosure. So if the pay period is weekly, they get paid weekly, they got to file a disclosure each week. How much money did we pay that employee this week that they worked? The same idea with non-periodics, they can get trumped. The garnishment can get trumped by not so much IRS liens, because they usually only go bank accounts, child support. Or somebody else got a garnishment in there, served a garnishment on them before you did. That or child support. That trumps everything. Obviously, for public policy reasons, because we have to support children that have dependent parents and are providing that support. So once the 90 days are up, you're still owed money, you're still working at the same place, you got to file another garnishment. And the 90-day period starts all over again. But we got a couple rules here of exemption. Minimum wage, exempt. What is it in Michigan now, 7.25?
7.45.
7.25, isn't it? So, 7.25, and that may be your job someday in business. You may be working for a business, you may be doing all this kind of stuff for that business. 7.25 times 40 hours is going to be exempt from the garnishment.
Is that before or after taxes?
That is after taxes and after child support. Child support is priority. So that comes out first. All child support orders in Michigan since 1991 are supposed to be by order of income withholding. And we're not supposed to be any more voluntary payment of child support in Michigan in the last 20 years. So that comes off first. And taxes, not a voluntary savings that the employee is having taken out of the check. That's voluntary. That's added back in. So it's only the deductions that the employee has no choice over. Those come out. Child support comes out. And if all he has left other than that is minimum wage, you get nothing on your garnishment. Okay, he's got more than minimum wage. That's all you can get. 25% of the entire check. If there is 25% left after we take out the minimum wage. So 25% of net pay minus minimum wage is the amount that the judgment creditor can get after he wins his breach of contract lawsuit.
Is it limited to 25%? So if five people try to come in and garnish your wages,
No. Only one garnishment at a time.
Oh, it's only
so
one.
Well, that one garnishment's in effect. Nobody else can say anything because that one garnishee is going to get it. He's going to get it all.
Yeah, well, that could go on for 30 years.
No. We go for 90 days, and then whichever one serves them first gets them for the next 90 days.
Oh.
Again, a race in time. So that's what I like to do, and if I have them there for a creditor's exam, I don't know where they're working or I don't know where they're banking. It doesn't really matter where they're working, but where they're, I don't know where the bank account is. I get them to tell me where the bank account is, and then I keep them there until we can go down and half an hour maybe, serving the bank with the garnishment, and they're sitting there in that helpless feeling because they know that person that's sitting next to me leaves the courtroom. I think they figure out that's what's going to happen. So that, those are the rules for collecting judgments, and it's important you know stuff like that. Because you've got to be able to collect, do collections to be able to stay in business. One other thing.
What chapter is this?
Saturday night chapter.
Oh.
This is Michigan law.
Okay.
Let's say you're on the opposite side. You're on the debtor side. Are you helpless and powerless? No. Because the judge has the authority to issue an order to set payment on the judgment. This is only out of wages. So if the judgment debtor files a petition and schedules a hearing in front of the judge and say, Judge, I want to make $50 a month payments. And I don't want to have to be garnished to make my life hell on top of that. If the judge finds that the person has no other assets with which to pay the judgment, or he doesn't have a whole bunch of money in the bank that they want in the lotto, and your only way they can pay it is from this job, and if the judge finds that they can only afford to make $50 payments a month, the judge has the authority to force the creditor to accept those payments. But the way the judge will do this, the way you can set that order up is you can set them up to fail. In the event that they are one day late in making the payment, I can file garnishments. The order to set payments is set aside in the event that they're late with a payment.
Can I request that the judge set an order to set, or make an order to set payment as a plaintiff? I'm a landlord and I got tenants and they're not paying rent, and I can't ask the judge to.
No. We're going to cover landlord and tenant. When you come back, you have a test March 28th. You come back April 3rd, is it? I think we said we were going to do the case is April 10th, I think, right? We'll be done in May.
No.
You guys want to keep meeting here in May? I don't like Monday nights. I don't mind.
No.
It's a lot of fun for me.
That's when I want to do my team.
I think that's what we're doing. We're doing it April 10th.
Yeah.
Or 11th. And then the 18th, we're room for the final exam. And so April 3rd, we're going to talk about landlord tenant and real estate and principals and agents. Can I do all that in one night?
But you can.
One
try.
What's that?
Yeah.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
If you've got an order to set payments arrangement with the judge, can you then be garnished by someone else?
No.
So it counts the same.
By someone else, yeah. That order only deals with that one creditor.
But it also makes you vulnerable to garnishments from other people.
It does.
Okay.
It